From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Ohio Congressman James Traficant took to the airwaves this week as guest host for a local radio call-in show. His appearance, which was also broadcast on C-SPAN, drew the criticism that it could taint the Cleveland jury pool for his upcoming trial for bribery and racketeering. Traficant faced similar accusations in 1983 in a high-profile trial. From NPR member station WCPN, David C. Barnett reports on how this master of the soundbite has used the media to maintain a folk hero status in his district.
A minivan pulls up in front of the Youngstown Federal Courthouse, and a flock of journalists and photographers surrounds the man who steps out. Congressman James Traficant smiles as a reporter asks him how he feels.
Most people have problems with a fly on their face. I have an elephant eating my ass.
The scribes chuckle. This is vintage Jim Traficant, short and sweet, rude and crude. For nearly 20 years, Ohio's 17th District Congressman has flaunted convention, much to the pleasure of his constituents. Sporting a 70s vintage polyester suit and a gray hairdo that's been compared to a bird's nest, Jim Traficant gives off the image of a guy who doesn't care if you're offended by the way he talks or looks. All he says he's interested in is helping the people of his district. United Church of Christ minister Werner Lang says that Traficant's strong local following has roots back in the days when he was county sheriff.
When the steel mills were shut down here in the late 1970s, there was a lot of foreclosures, people being thrown out of their homes. One such family was in Struthers, and the judge foreclosed on him and ordered Jim Traficant to evict them. Jim Traficant refused to evict him as sheriff, and the judge threw him in jail. That made him overnight a working-class hero in this community.
This part of Northeast Ohio is known as the Valley, after the Mahoning River Valley, which defined a corridor of steel mills that shut down due to hard economic times 20 years ago. And then Sheriff Traficant's working-class hero status was further tested with accusations of bribery and racketeering in connection with the Valley's powerful mob. To the surprise of many, he beat the federal charges against him by conducting his own defense in a controversial trial that cemented his heroic stature and led to 9 terms as a member of Congress.
He certainly has a very strong core support out there.
David Skolnick is a political reporter for the Youngstown Vindicator.
If he was to run for re-election today, I'd put his chances at 50-50 of winning, even with a 10-count federal indictment staring him right in the face.
In mid-April, federal prosecutors indicted James Traficant on new charges of bribery, racketeering, and tax evasion. And now, once again, the congressman is preparing to conduct his own defense in a trial due to begin next year. This past week, he took his case to the people as the substitute host of a local talk show.
Let's go to Conneaut, to Judy. Judy, you're on the air with Congressman Traficant.
Hi, Jim. I sympathize with your frustration with the government. I was a teacher.
Among the members of Jim Traficant's radio audience this week was Dr. Thomas Flynn, an associate professor of communication at nearby Slippery Rock University across the border in Pennsylvania.
He fits right into the Clear Channel lineup of Dr. Laura and Rush Limbaugh and the Savage Nation and kind of all the people who tend to speak of conspiracies in the government. That's Jim Traficant's natural constituency, I think, is that audience.
I think you could answer this problem with that energy shortage out there in California. Just turn off every other street light instead of paying off all these government agencies that get kickbacks through the power companies.
Listen,
or however that works.
If we all shut our air conditioners off and stop buying gas for a week, they'd all bring the prices down in half.
There you go.
But think about it.
In recent years, the soundbite-savvy Traficant has gained some notoriety for his special order one-minute speeches from the floor of the House. Communications analyst Thomas Flynn says that the one-minute format is open to all representatives.
Jim Traficant, beginning about a year and a half ago, began in a series of speeches to talk about corruption in the Justice Department, treason on behalf of Janet Reno, corruption in the local FBI that's been conducting the 2-year investigation into corruption in the mafia and government here in Youngstown. And through this, he kind of developed what I call an attack strategy.
Together. I yield back what should be the next endangered species in the United States of America, the Internal Rectal Service.
Youngstown Vindicator politics reporter David Skolnick sees Jim Trafficant as displaying a rumpled persona, the Columbo-like congressman that some people don't take seriously.
He's very calculating, and I think he does that in order to allow people to put their guard down and maybe not treat him as, you know, so seriously, and then he can, you know, work his Trafficant magic.
The official Washington media doesn't pay much attention to Jim Trafficant.
Communication expert Thomas Flynn thinks it's time they did.
Jim Trafficant is very able, using the one-minute speeches, using the press releases, using appearances on talk radio like this, to bypass the scrutiny of the local media. There are local media who have questions that they want to ask. There are very serious charges being leveled against Jim Trafficant.
I'm out of here.
Thank you very much
to make any comments about my case would place my situation into a legal trick bag, and my attorney has advised me, and I will not be caught.
I think it's time to take our government back. I think it's time to look them in the eye, like a junkyard dog in the face of a hurricane.
Many here in the Valley see Jim Trafficant as a junkyard underdog. Some wonder how many times this congressional Rocky can make a late-round comeback. But nobody's counting him out yet. For On the Media, I'm David C. Barnett in Youngstown.
Just the son of a truck driver. Proud of that intelligent guy. I'm very glad to have come into your home. You can reach me at the U.S. Courthouse, Youngstown, Ohio. Jim Trafficant, I've got a train to run. See you back in Washington. Take care.
If Jim Trafficant is Rocky, Tom Grant was Don Quixote. Don Quixote with a handheld mic, a local TV newsman who thought he could make a difference. But after a long career ending at KXLY in Spokane, Washington, Grant recently stopped fighting the good fight and moved to print. He joins us now. Tom, congratulations on escaping the dark side. How long were you in the business?
I've been in television for 16 years. I started back in 1986. I've worked at the stations from Alaska to Vermont and worked here in Spokane for about 10 years.
16 years, Tom. That's 5,840 days. It took you 5,840 days to figure out that TV news sucks.
I must be incredibly stupid, huh? The thing about television news is that it's incredibly fun to do. You talk to people about interesting subjects, then you rush back to the station and you put it all together and you write a few transitions and the story airs and people usually, they say great things about it, not necessarily because of anything you've done, but because, you know, you put somebody's face on TV. And at the end of the day, you go home, the story's over, and you feel good about it. I liked doing TV. The trouble with TV is that if you want to do important stories, significant stories about your community, there are so many other forces that come to bear on you now that you can't do them all the time. And I felt like I was in a box. I was trapped. And they kept cutting off exits all the time, ways that I wanted to go.
Local TV news is ratings generated. It presses emotional hot buttons. It stays away from controversy that will offend its local advertisers. It's superficial. It's bloody. It's all of the things we despise. Now, for someone who's been in the business for as long as you have and with the resume you have, even participating in local TV news has to be something like a deal with the devil. Did you feel over your 16 years in the business that you were you had carved out some sort of deal with the devil?
Yeah, what can I say? Yeah, I mean, I was getting paid to do stories that many times were superficial. There came times when I would go out and do a story, and they would tell me what the story was going to be after I came back. And I knew the story wasn't that, but they would keep pushing it and pushing it, and they would rewrite my leads to juice it up, to make it more sensational than it was. And there were times when I found myself going along with this, and that's one of the things that was extremely troubling to me.
Stop me if I'm getting too nosy, but I'm thinking cinematically here, and I have this image of you coming home from work, sitting there in the dark at your kitchen table with an open bottle of cheap hooch next to you. What form did your feeling bad about yourself take in your life?
Did I come back and sit down with some cheap hooch once in a while? I certainly did. I felt like I wasn't really well the last 6 or 8 months. I wasn't taking care of myself. I wasn't as healthy as I should have been. As the pressures on television to become profit centers grow, there are more pressures put on people like me to not do things that will anger, you know, various people or will cost us a lot of money, like a lawsuit. And so we back away from doing anything but pablum.
So you're sort of Don Quixote and thinking that on the strength of your will and the righteousness of your vision and of your accomplishments to date, that you could have somehow tilted at the TV news windmill and won victories for journalism. You failed. The windmill won. What would you tell other Don Quixotes who are trying to do the same thing and make TV news bend to their journalistic ambitions as opposed to the vice versa?
Yeah, I lost. Okay, I had to give up and leave. But I've had emails from people who ask me about that very thing. And you know, what can I say to them? But I hope you find a good station. There are a few of them out there. And if you find one of those good stations and then you push hard enough, you will be able to make a difference even as a TV journalist.
Yeah, I know that place. It's Channel 56, Brigadoon. Tom Grant, thank you for joining us.
Okay, thank you.
Tom Grant is formerly a reporter with KXLY-TV, Spokane, and now news editor of the Spokane Local Planet.
Coming up, Plato's views on sex in the media, reporting on the dearly departed and G-men in the movies.
This is On the Media from National Public Radio. We're back with On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. A couple of weeks ago, KBOO, a non-commercial radio station in Portland, Oregon, was fined $7,000 for playing a song. We won't play much of it because we don't want to be fined, although another program on WNYC, our producing station, did play a different version of the song with the same lyrics. WNYC has not been fined, apparently because nobody complained to the FCC, while someone in Oregon did. The FCC gave KBOO 30 days to respond. The song is called Revolution, a feminist tract that says in no uncertain and very explicit terms that men should not try to equate political revolution with promiscuous sex.
Your revolution will not be you killing me softly with Fuji's. Your revolution ain't gonna knock me up without no ring and produce little future MCs. Because that revolution will not happen between these thighs. Your revolution will not find me in the backseat of a Jeep with LL.
The commission has defined indecent speech as language that depicts in terms patently offensive according to community standards for broadcast, sexual or excretory activities or organs. That's one standard. Apparently America has a million of them. Marjorie Hines, a First Amendment lawyer, so you know where she stands, has written a history of the subject that ranges across some 25 centuries called Not in Front of the Children, Indecency, Censorship, and the Innocence of Youth. And she joins us now. Welcome to On the Media.
Thanks.
So where do you think that the song Your Revolution fits into community standards? Some of that language is pretty rough.
Actually, in comparison to other rap music and other forms of entertainment and information that are out there today, I found it remarkably tame. And what's most interesting about this FCC punishment of this radio station is that the song is an explicitly feminist protest against the kind of disrespect of women that has been of concern, certainly among our political leaders, in terms of sexual attitudes. And the FCC chooses to censor this.
You say it's not nearly as rough as a lot of songs that are out there, but those songs aren't necessarily being broadcast.
Well, that goes, of course, to the FCC's special status as our only official federal censorship agency.
The FCC is responding to a community complaint.
Well, one complaint. And it's interesting, if you go back to the history of FCC indecency enforcement, the famous case, the Pacifica Radio case, where the Supreme Court ultimately upheld the power of the FCC to punish Pacifica Radio for playing a comic monologue that used these seven words that you supposedly couldn't say on the airwaves in an explicitly political way. That was based on a complaint out of New York City by somebody who was on the Board of Morality and Media. He did not represent the standards of that community. I very much doubt that this complainant in Portland, who was offended by this feminist rap song, represented the standards of that community.
The idea that certain material is dangerous for kids is as old as Plato is. He subscribed to the idea that kids will imitate what they see or hear.
He objected to most of the myths and most of the poetry that we now consider classic, because he thought children should be basically given indoctrination rather than an education that would enable them to think. And Plato's Republic is really a prescription for a totalitarian state, brilliant as much of the dialogue is. The reason I started the book with Plato was, in fact, that a court cited Plato in ruling against a teacher who had raised a free expression claim in a school censorship case. That seemed remarkably inappropriate given Plato's philosophy and its inconsistency with the free expression values that we have in this country.
Now, there seems to have been a tug of war over the notion that, on the one hand, kids were unstained beings of purity and innocence, and on the other hand, that they're vessels of bestial impulses and evil thoughts that have to be controlled, and either option seems to call for censorship.
The rhetoric about childhood innocence began to become much more prominent in the 19th century, and I trace the anti-masturbation hysteria and myths that led to some pretty horrendous kinds of restrictions. The progression or regression from there to censorship laws that focused on sexual material was pretty logical. An English judge said in what is the seminal obscenity case in the 1860s, if you want to prevent young and vulnerable readers from having libidinous thoughts, then it would be natural to censor and suppress literature with sexual content.
But nobody talks about that anymore as a reason for censorship. The basis now is something called the Harmful to Minors Statute. So what does it mean to be harmful to minors?
The Harmful to Minors standard, which is a legal standard invented by the Supreme Court, as well as the related but different indecency standard that the Federal Communications Commission uses, are defined in only the vaguest terms, and it may not explicitly talk about libidinous thoughts or masturbation, but it is all premised on the same notion that this sexual knowledge is not appropriate for kids.
So what is brewing on the legislative front regarding kids and access to media?
We have two federal laws that were passed in the last couple of years. One mandates internet filters in all schools and libraries that receive any form of federal financial assistance, which of course will have its impact disproportionately on low-income communities. The second law, which the Supreme Court just agreed to review, is a criminal law that basically bans expression that is quote-unquote harmful to minors on the World Wide Web. And it's a very vague, open-ended standard.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Marjorie Hines is author of Not in Front of the Children, Indecency, Censorship, and the Innocence of Youth.
This weekend, nearly 30 journalists are converging on Las Vegas, New Mexico, for the third Great Obituary Writers Conference. The event is organized by Carolyn Gilbert, an obit consultant from Dallas, and she joins us now. Carolyn, welcome to OTM.
Thank you very much.
This is your third annual conference?
It is, the third Great Obituary Writers Conference.
Just curious, what will you be discussing this year that you didn't cover in the other two?
Well, you have to understand that every day you have a new chapter of obituaries, not only in the United States, in the world.
The one ongoing issue of obituary writing that I can think of, what to do to memorialize the life of a high-achieving scoundrel. When Dan Rostenkowski dies someday, how high up do you put the prison term?
Good point. You don't want to leave it out because that, as far as history is concerned, is not fair. It's not a fair story. You don't want to make too much of it, but then again, it is judgmental on the part of the writer as to where it actually fits in the scheme of things.
Because you know that some percentage of your readers will be going, oh, for crying out loud, the man is dead, just leave him alone.
Right, right.
Why do people read the obituaries? I mean, apart from the overriding news value.
Well, I guess there is a curiosity factor, and it's kind of a marker of your own life to read the obituaries and see the procession of those who are dying and who are memorialized in the obituaries.
And I guess in a way it's life-affirming because if you're reading the obituaries, why, you're not the guest of honor.
That's right.
Now, this may be sensitive to some of your membership, but obituary writing is traditionally a starting point in journalism or a dumping ground for people deemed to be no longer of great service to the rest of the news pages. Is there a stigma attached to obituary writing?
The subject is one of continuing concern every time we get these people together because very often the young writer comes in as assigned to the obit desk and thinks it is a punishment, or in retirement someone is assigned to the obit desk. We really firmly believe that the obituary writer should be the best writer on the staff.
There's a sort of death vigil file at a lot of news organizations. The obituary for John Paul II and Bob Hope and Ronald Reagan are almost certainly written at most newspapers in the United States. And that has a kind of Deadpool quality to it where you have to, you know, you're just waiting for someone finally to succumb. Do the members of this conference have a kind of Deadpool of their own?
I think every writer does have in his head the advancer file, as it's called. And, you know, it's not only the rich and famous that you're waiting to die. You know the people in your community who are going to be looked at in historical terms that you really need to have a wonderful obituary ready.
You mean you call the person and say, listen,
we know you're going to die, no.
I mean, that must be an awkward telephone call.
No, you know, it's more like, and I'm sure every writer has his own technique for approaching that, but probably the most popular way is to assure the person that you really want an in-depth interview so that whenever the time comes.
Kind of like, you know, having that fantasy of going to your own funeral.
That's right. That's right.
It's actually can be quite flattering.
That's right.
If the presumption weren't that you're about to die.
Yeah, you want to be careful how you phrase these things.
Well, thank you very much, Carolyn. It's been a great pleasure.
Thank you so much, Bob.
Carolyn Gilbert is organizing the third Great Obituary Conference in Las Vegas, New Mexico.
All in all, it hasn't been a good week for the FBI. Timothy McVeigh asked for a stay of execution because the FBI bungled the delivery of documents to the defense. And veteran FBI man Robert Hansen, accused of spying on the agency for 15 years, pleaded innocent. On the positive side, the four defendants fingered by the FBI for the 1998 embassy bombings in Kenya and Tanzania were convicted. But over the last several years, in such debacles as Ruby Ridge and Richard Jewell, Waco and Wen-Ho Lee, the FBI has developed a serious image problem. Oh, for the halcyon days of Hoover, when our hearts were young and gay.
Gee, but I'd like to be a G-man and go bang, 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 bang. I'd be a brave gang-busting he-man and go bang, 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 bang. I'd put on disguises of all different sizes, and would I win prizes for telling who spies is?
I'll tell you, things have really changed.
Ronald Kessler is author of Inside the FBI, the world's most powerful law enforcement agency.
Under Hoover, the Bureau created this image of this invincible agency where they always got their man. They did this through the media, through radio shows, TV shows, movies that they controlled.
Many of the incidents in the story you are about to hear are based on the actual records and authentic experiences of Matt Savetic, who for 9 fantastic years lived as a communist for the FBI. Here is our star, Dana Andrews, as Matt Savetic.
J. Edgar Hoover, the agency's public face, policed the agency's image through an office with the impenetrable name of the Crimes Records Division. It was charged with furnishing what were called interesting case memoranda to the radio shows and later the TV shows and movies over which Hoover exercised an invincible veto power. He was ever vigilant in pursuit of good PR.
I am your new director. I did not ask for the position, but now that I have it, I intend to give it the best I have. The Bureau will operate solely on efficiency, and we are going to do it as a team. Henceforth, it will be a we organization.
Once upon a time, Hollywood loved the organization.
David Edelstein is the film critic for Slate.com.
There was something very, very reassuring about the discipline, the order, the routine, the sticking to the rules. There was something very reassuring about those men in those gray suits, all with identical haircuts.
But the love affair had cooled for the average American round about 1975 with the Senate investigation of the FBI under Frank Church. Richard Powers is the author of G-Men, Hoover's FBI in American Popular Culture.
That pretty much blew the lid off all of the FBI horrors that Hoover had kept, you know, bottled up over all those years. The Church Committee delved particularly into the FBI's harassment of Martin Luther King Jr. And so as you had King emerging as one of the great heroes of American life in the 20th century, his great antagonist was J. Edgar Hoover.
Hoover always said justice would prevail, and it did. After the revelations of the Church Committee, Hoover's attempts to destroy King as a leader boomeranged.
Once you have an image that the FBI promoted during the 1930s of being an omnipotent, all-knowing, all-powerful agency that never could make a mistake, it was setting itself up for a terrible fall.
Already, the culture was tiring of the organization man. It was the end of a long battle Hoover had waged with Hollywood since 1935, when James Cagney played a renegade G-man. The agency hated the film, but grew to love it because it boosted the FBI's popularity like gangbusters. Author Richard Powers says that Americans always embraced characters that were square pegs and round holes, even as Hoover labored to shave the edges off.
And that's what successful adventure entertainment is all about, and it was completely contrary to the FBI image. And so they were really at loggerheads.
So the image of the FBI splintered. Films like the Die Hard series showed up the FBI as officious and obstructionist bureaucrats.
Now, talk to me. What's going on here?
That's the FBI. They got the universal terrorist playbook, and they're running it step by step.
Meanwhile, the Bureau regained a measure of its old omniscience with a Jodie Foster vehicle.
Yeah, Starling, tell me what you see.
Oh, he's a white male. Serial killers tend to hunt within their own ethnic groups. He's not a drifter. He's got his own house somewhere, not an apartment.
Why?
What he does with them takes privacy. And he He's never impulsive. He'll never stop.
Why not?
Got a real taste for it now, and he's getting better at his work.
Not bad, Starling.
Louis Starling and Silence of the Lambs probably did more for the Bureau as a fictional case than any real case, any real publicity that the Bureau could have done. It was amazing.
Ex-profiler John Douglas is the model for Agent Starling's mentor, Jack Crawford, played by Scott Glenn.
The character was very, very serious, and I always told the people working with me after we saw the movie, if I was that serious day in and day out, I'd be wearing a blue chiffon dress, smoking a cigar. I just wouldn't be able to keep up that intensity.
And just as Cagney's G-Man infuriated the Bureau for a while, so did Silence of the Lambs.
A lot of high-ups in the FBI itself at first didn't like the movie. They said it was very, very violent. And when I went to a movie screening, I got up and I said, I don't know what the rest of you think in the FBI, what kind of work we're doing here, but I see this work day in and day out. This violence does exist in our country.
But the higher-ups piped down when recruitment soared.
Damn, you know, who wouldn't want to sign up and go out and hunt themselves some serial killers?
Critic David Edelstein says that despite anecdotal evidence to the contrary, the gods of Tinseltown have consistently favored the Bureau with positive portrayals.
In the beginning, the FBI was all that stood between us freedom-loving Americans and those nasty immigrant gangsters. Then the FBI was all that stood between us and that evil communist menace. Then when the communist menace no longer seemed so imminent, suddenly the FBI was out doing battle with right-wing white supremacists and the Ku Klux Klan.
Even the X-Files, which depicts a dark and dangerous place, an agency at war with itself, has proved a boon to the FBI. As long as it seems powerful, the Bureau can't lose.
It's only in very, very, very rare instances that the FBI is portrayed as incompetent, which seems to me the worst danger to an organization that thrives on secrecy and that presents itself as a model of superhuman and enlightened efficiency.
Actually, according to a Washington Post ABC poll released last week, 52% of the public believes the handling of evidence in the Oklahoma City bombing case is a sign of deeper problems at the FBI. And just 53% of those polled have a favorable impression of the FBI, down from 82% 6 years ago. Maybe the Bureau should look for its next director in Hollywood.
Criminals come, but they have one way to go. Gangsters are dumb, for by now they ought to know. Pick you up there or they can you over there. Hoover will bring them to the electric chair.
D-D-E-F-T, G-Man, G-Man, Hoover. Rat-tat-tat, tat, rat-tat-tat, tat, rat-tat-tat.
Coming up, we consider the casting of actors. Race matters less on Broadway, and beauty is overrated in Hollywood. Also, your letters.
This is On the Media from National Public Radio.
Once again, and probably for the last time, welcome back to On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Time now for some of your letters. Our discussion 2 weeks ago with NPR correspondent Rick Carr on the intellectual property argument over DVDs was a complex one, and it elicited equally complex responses. The problem is not with mass production per se, wrote William Roper. It's with the fact that it's digital, meaning there's no degeneration from copy to copy. With everybody having access to technology that can create infinite copies as good as the original, copyright holders like myself are at jeopardy in a way we never were before.
Bram Dulcourt of Valhalla, New York, added the techie angle. I can still read the DVD without decrypting it, but the encryption makes it look like gibberish. I can copy the gibberish and give it to a friend, still encrypted. When he tries to play it, his licensed DVD player strips off the encryption, just like the movie was a store-bought original. And cynic Chad Lauritsen from Logan, Iowa, had only this to say. The encryption of DVDs is really just a way for the makers of movies or DVDs to control who can sell the hardware to view them.
We received a polite reminder last week from Alan Thorpe in Castledale, Utah, that we are a national show with an occasional East Coast bias. Commenting on Scott Sugar's observations about the Washington Post and its dubious journalistic practices, he says, "I'll never read that paper again, should it happen to be on sale here in Utah." An extended apology from OTM to listeners residing everywhere else. Dave Crabtree said he enjoyed Brian Mann's piece on GE's campaign to sway public opinion, but notes that environmentalists often use the same tactics, albeit less sophisticated. His is a rallying cry for media outlets like NPR to alert the public to these misinformation campaigns. In my opinion, he says, NPR has been a little lax in this regard.
And lastly, Valerie Richardson from Bridgeport, Connecticut, is on the acronym watch. She writes that she's growing increasingly irritated with us referring to the show as OTM. "Are you trying to increase the amount of content that can be squeezed into an hour?" she asks. Well, yeah, exactly right. For every acronym we use, vital seconds are saved. That way, the PRLs can get their VFM from NPR.
This weekend, the year's Tony Awards are being presented to the best of Broadway. Brian Stokes Mitchell is up for a Tony for his role in August Wilson's King Hedley II. Last year, Mitchell won for his role in Cole Porter's musical Kiss Me, Kate, a black actor in a traditionally white role. Of course, most roles in musical revivals are traditionally white, if that means originated by white actors. On the Media's Tony Macillus reports on the origins and the evolution of non-traditional casting.
"Why, there's a wench. Come on and kiss me, cakes. So kiss me, cakes."
Wearing a sweater vest and seated in his stately Manhattan brownstone, Philip Rose does not appear particularly revolutionary. Yet, those are the words used to describe him in the 60s. He was a theater producer, a hot one, and controversial, having just produced the hit play A Raisin in the Sun. An idea struck him.
"There are so many roles that are nondescript in terms of color. They don't say it's a white man or a white woman, a black man or a black woman. The theater owners and the theater producers and the writers just assumed that it would be all white people because that's what they were writing about."
In the 1960s, when the script for a two-person love story, The Owl and the Pussycat, came across his desk, he thought it would be perfect for Diana Sands, a black actress, and Alan Alda, a white actor.
"At the time, people were calling me up, even friends of mine, saying, 'You're crazy. I mean, how can you do this?' But we did."
Rose cast a white actress as the understudy in Owl and the Pussycat. He describes one very important evening in 1964 when the lead lost her voice on stage.
"After the first 5 minutes or so of the play, she was supposed to go off to the bathroom while Alan Alda went off to the bedroom. And she entered the bathroom, closed the door, and came out about a minute or so later. Only who came out was the white understudy in Diana's costume. Well, of course, there was an enormous laugh from the audience. But then the understudy went on to finish the play. It didn't change anything. It didn't change a word. And it just made the point that that could be done, and it didn't matter."
The box office success of Rose's plays were a signal to less adventurous producers. Casting actors of color would not hurt profits. The Owl and the Pussycat went on the road to equal success with another non-traditional choice, a Catwoman.
"Ow."
At 73, Eartha Kitt is still making men uncomfortable with her timeless sex appeal. She is currently touring as the fairy godmother in Cinderella, a non-traditional role. She wonders why stage talent is held up to a different standard than other professions.
The sports world has no color. If you're playing the game well and you're one of the best, then why should any of us be thought of in terms of color? We should be thought of in terms of talent or our capabilities.
That's what the non-traditional casting project wants casting directors to ask. The nonprofit organization was founded in 1986 after an actors' equity study revealed that 90% of employed actors were white. The staff keeps a database containing resumes and photos for nearly 3,000 actors of color and has helped place them in over 3,200 productions in regional theater, Broadway, and television. Sharon Jensen heads up the non-traditional casting project.
We don't insist that Hamlet is Danish. We don't insist that St. Joan is French. We still go along with those stories because they're powerful stories, and we believe if we have a powerful enough actor who is transformational enough to take us along in those journeys.
It's not a journey that every theatergoer is willing to take. John Simon is the theater critic for New York Magazine.
I do think history has to be accounted for. I am bothered when Hamlet is played by a black actor, quite aside from the fact that he may be good, bad, or indifferent. It just doesn't ring historically true.
Simon criticized a revival of Carousel, for which African-American actress Audra McDonald won a Tony. The musical, set at the end of the 19th century in New England, was cast with several interracial couples.
Not only is it unhistoric, but it is biological when the same person's brother and mother and father are all white and then suddenly this person is black, and it sets up questions. I mean, what kind of indiscretions did his mother indulge in?
But plays aren't documentaries, says casting director Arnold Mongioli.
It's absolutely ridiculous that in that time period, the husband is white, the wife is black, the cousin is white, the aunt is black. And my response was, but the rocking horse glued sideways to the roof. That didn't bother you at all.
Mongioli's casting credits include Ragtime, Fosse, and Candide, all of which employed several actors of color. He cast Diane Carroll for the role of Norma Desmond in the Toronto production of Sunset Boulevard. He recalls a press conference when a Canadian critic asked his star the inevitable question. You're black and Norma Desmond is white. Can you comment on that?
And Diane Carroll said with perfect sang-froid, certainly. First of all, Norma Desmond is a creation of Billy Wilder's imagination. So we don't know what color she is, do we? Secondly, this is a story about a woman who fears aging. She is 50 years old. I have long passed my 50th birthday, and I understand the emotional arc of this character. The man was silenced. I wish forever.
New York Magazine's John Simon.
What I particularly would object to is affirmative action casting. A part calling for a white actor is deliberately given to a black actor who is not nearly so suited for that part as some white actor who is equally a candidate for that role.
There seems to be little danger of rampant non-traditional casting. It has only been in recent decades that Asian actors, for example, actually got to play Asian roles. Christine Toy Johnson is a member of the non-traditional casting project. She has performed on Broadway and off for over 15 years.
If a breakdown came down for a role of a female who was born and raised in Scarsdale, was a cheerleader, had a passion for musical theater, blah, 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 right? And it was on Broadway, you can bet that I would not be brought in on the first run for this, although I just described myself.
An all-American girl. Johnson has roots in the U.S. tracing back to 1850, but she's 100% Chinese. And that's all casting directors tend to see. But she admits it's getting better. Her agent has recently gotten her auditions for those all-American roles she identifies with. They would have been out of the question a few years ago.
If you will see me, I will show up and let you know that I can tell the story. And if you let me tell the story, I can pretty much guarantee that the audience will not go running, screaming from the theater saying, oh my God, you put a person of color on your stage.
Philip Rose proved that on that fateful night during the run of The Owl and the Pussycat, when colors changed in an instant, leaving the meaning of the play unscathed. He recalls those days in his new book titled You Can't Do That on Broadway. Thanks in part to him, now you can. The non-traditional casting project is currently waiting for results from a national survey of diversity in theater companies. They're hoping that the faces on stage now better reflect those on the streets. For On the Media, I'm Tony Macillis in New York.
The flowers will be buzzing with the hum of bees. The birds will make a racket in the churchyard trees.
While the trend is away from casting actors according to race, that doesn't mean that looks don't matter. Looks matter, as Garfield learned during his last trip to the West Coast.
They flock here to Los Angeles to convert their looks into Hollywood careers because, let's face it, not everybody is a natural talent like Keanu Reeves or Heather Graham. Most of the wannabes are just striking faces on an 8x10.
We get like a big stack of like 25 or so submissions in the mail every day. Literally, I have every person's hopes and dreams sitting on my desk, and they all think that they're going to be movie stars.
Robin Harrington is the co-owner of Dragon, the talent agency, a bulky elevator ride above Wilshire Boulevard. Dragon is not the ordinary Hollywood magnet for the impossibly gorgeous, however. The headshots here are conspicuously thin on square jaws, high cheekbones, and perfect pearly smiles. In fact, a good part of the clientele is pretty heinous looking, which works out very well for them because at the moment, as measured by the casting breakdowns with physical specifications for roles in TV, film, and advertising, we are in a raging bull market for the unsightly.
Braces, freckles, pimples, too skinny, heavy. It's rare that I see the breakdown that is looking for the gorgeous beauty. It's all about real people right now. Like, we are looking for inbred.
There will always be a demand for gods and goddesses, of course, but the trend now is toward geek chic. And worse.
They were looking for an African-American man, maybe like 35, 40, who was missing a thumb. And it's not like we really have, you know, a missing thumb department, something like that. You know what I mean? Can't they just use a makeup artist or something?
Well, no. I'm like, get real.
The majority of the people that I cast these days are beyond real.
Casting agent Kathy Carlton sits in her West L.A. office sifting through 8x10s.
Like this guy right here, Chip.
Yeah, he's not hideous, but, you know, Omar Sharif, he ain't.
No. This girl, I think she's about 6'2". Sweet as can be, you know. She works a lot, but she's definitely not beautiful. And we have Bunny Summers, who is just a sweetheart, and it's all about her weight and her jowls, and she just makes the best of it, loves it, you know, booked her many times. You know, she just enjoys her layers there.
It may seem counterintuitive in a town where superficiality runs so deep that a young woman would regard her weight and jowls as a meal ticket, but there you are. Take Vincent Schiavelli. He is not, strictly speaking, a handsome guy. His ultra-drooping eyes give him a basset hound look that is so severe he's only been able to get parts in 80 movies. 80 movies. Just to put that in perspective, Brad Pitt has been in 23 movies. Of course, none of Brad Pitt's was Rescue from Gilligan's Island.
My face is my fortune, baby. But on the other hand, somehow the particular nature of my looks, people might tend to think that I am a certain way that I'm not.
He's not deeply depressed, for example, or deranged, or a ghost, even though he played one in Ghost. He's a trained actor who likes to take advantage of what he calls his physicality, without the parts being about his physicality. When directors call looking for that strange-looking guy with the eyes, he'd prefer to say no, but...
You have to do them because you have to work, because you have bills to pay and you have expenses and so on and so forth. Then it's like... Okay, let's go to work. Yeah.
I think we like to laugh, and we don't laugh at beautiful people.
Rich Silverstein of Goodby Silverstein & Partners, the San Francisco ad agency, has often cast TV spots with the unbeautiful. A recent commercial for E-Trade was about a grotesque Gloria Swanson type getting an erotic pedicure from her pool boy. Another, for Frito-Lay, used a family of overweight trailer trash to demonstrate Frito's new crush-proof packaging.
I'm your aunt, Debbie!
They say there are no small parts, only small actors. These are extremely large actors cast for their girth. But Silverstein says he had no difficulty getting people to audition.
Andy Warhol was so right. Everyone can be famous for 15 minutes, and no one says no.
Yeah, but you've got to wonder, when the agent calls saying, Frito-Lay is looking for obese, obnoxious losers, are you available? What goes on in the actor's mind, in terms of self-image, in terms of self-esteem, in terms of just plain human vanity? Doesn't that take a toll?
And I played with some very interesting people, such as Hervé Villechance from Fantasy Island.
Meet Coco Barrett of the comedy team Coco and Penny. Once upon a time, she was a buxom young character actress and comedian who got tantalizingly close to success in New York. Now she is in Hollywood, much older, much heavier, garishly clad and coiffed, all teased hair and leopard skin, still trying to break through.
I've done Law and Order, and I played a landlady. Very often I play a gypsy. In Carlito's Way, I played a fortune teller. They're not casting me as a glamorous young girl.
When Goodby Silverstein was looking for a grossly sexual Gloria Swanson, Coco jumped at the opportunity.
I just loved that one. I wish I could do that one. It was wonderful.
You wish you had the part where the idea was to look repulsive.
I guess so. I don't mind being me. I don't mind at all.
I'm reminded of the words of James Baldwin, which I read just now in Bartlett's quotations. The price we pay when pursuing any art or calling is an intimate knowledge of its ugly side. But maybe the reverse is true as well. The benefit we get from ugliness is a more intimate relationship with art. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Janine Price, Katya Rogers, and the award-winning Alicia Zuckerman. Engineered by George Edwards and Irene Trudell, and edited by Brooke. We had help from David Serchuk, Kathleen Horan, and Sean Landis.
Mike Pesca is our producer at large, Arun Roth, our senior producer, and Dean Capello, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. We'd like to welcome our newest station, WUWM in Milwaukee. You can listen to the program and get free transcripts at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. And don't forget to tell us where you live and how to pronounce your name. This is On the Media from National Public Radio. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
I'm Bob Garfield.
Ow!
Funding for On the Media is provided by the Ford Foundation, the Florence and John Schumann Foundation, the Bidell Foundation, the John T. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This program is a production of WNYC Radio New York. This is NPR, National Public Radio.